Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition, friends and family edition. I had the great pleasure today of having my old friend Jason Jenkins in here. Jason and I went to college together. We worked at Mexicali Grill in Athens, Georgia, together, and we, in fact, were hired on the very same day. And Jason became a good friend right away, and as I tell him, I had the great opportunity to tell someone something face-to-face that was meaningful. Which is something that everyone should do when you get the chance. And I was going to put it in an email over the years, but I finally got to sit down with Jason and tell him what an impact he had on my life. He was a big influence culturally, introduced me to so many things, took my life in a direction culturally that I was might not have gone in otherwise. Who knows? And I listed off some things that he introduced me to. And then since we recorded, I kept thinking of more things, and I texted him. Things like D'Angelo and Frank Sinatra in earnest. And it just the list goes on and on. Jason's a great dude. He has done a very interesting thing with his lifestyle in that he uprooted his family in the States and said, we're going to live all over the world. And he's lived in Tokyo and Spain and Malaysia and Thailand and Mexico. And it's really cool. He's got a blog and a podcast called An Epic Education, where he details this stuff. And if you are interested in doing something radical with your life and moving your family all over the world, Jason's a good person to get some good advice from, and he is open to it. Great guy, great old friend, and we had a wonderful talk about his movie crush, the fantastic Hal Ashby, Peter Sellers, Jim from 1979, Being There. So here we go with Jason Jenkins on Being There.
Cheers.
Pull that a little closer, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sorry.
That's right. You can sit back. You can just pull the mic. Do
right.
Whatever you need to do to be comfortable.
Take your pants off. We came back to Japan about 6 months ago.
Okay.
And before that, we were in Mexico for about 2 years.
Right.
We were in the Yucatan Peninsula.
I wanted to get down to Mexico, man.
Would have been great to see it.
It's
a killer place. It gets a really bad rap here.
Yeah.
And I mean, deservedly so. There's some rough spots. But to throw the whole country out is ridiculous.
Right.
And that's a whole conversation.
It looks amazing.
Itself.
Emily and I want to go to Oaxaca at some point.
Oh, right. Okay. That's my sister got married there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She got married 6 years ago at this
nice.
Really cool place called Puerto Escondido.
Uh-huh.
And then it's the best wedding I've ever – best family memory we've ever had.
It was, wow.
It's amazing. Like, you know, the bioluminescence where, you know, the glow-in-the-dark stuff.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, releasing sea turtles, your girl would love it. And
yeah.
You would love it just because it's kind of laid back and not crowded.
Well, we're big into Frida Kahlo, too. So it's
right.
A lifelong dream to go to the Casa Azul.
Did I tell you, like, when my girl and I went to Casa Azul, we listened to The Stuff You Should Know.
Oh, really? On Frida Kahlo?
On Frida Kahlo beforehand.
Oh, nice.
And it was awesome. Yeah.
That's great.
Mexico City, if you want a city escape,
yeah.
Mexico City rocks.
Yeah.
If it was a little more stable, we would live there.
Really?
I mean, as far as museums and food and culture and events and like cool neighborhoods to
uh-huh.
walk around, it's amazing. It's amazing. It looks like Europe in a lot of ways.
Well, just for the benefit of the listener, I want to explain kind of
– Oh, sure.
Because I want to plug what you got going on too because you
okay. –
this is my friend Jason from college, which we'll get into that in a second too because
okay.
I have a lot of like – thanks that I need to give you that's long overdue for some things.
I don't know about that, but okay.
But you made a radical choice, which is, you know, it's only radical in view of the regular American way.
Okay.
But the radical choice many years ago when you got married and had kids to do something a little different with your life and to move all around the world with your family. And you have started – what all do you have now? Do you have a podcast and a blog or you still have the blog?
Oh, definitely got the blog going on. The podcast has been on hiatus for about a year now.
Okay.
Well, because see, my guests – this is actually my first experience to have a podcast face-to-face,
uh-huh.
like in a studio. It's
oh,
great.
Yeah, because you do remote stuff.
Well, my podcast was all about family travel.
Right.
And I was always interviewing family travelers who are, A, not experienced – with podcasts.
Right.
And B, always in some far-flung place with spotty Wi-Fi and not in a studio. So it's someone in Peru with a dog barking outside, or it's someone in Cambodia and her husband is like zipping the suitcase behind her. I'm like, can you stop that? You know, so. But when we were in Mexico recently, they were putting fiber optic into our neighborhood.
Oh, nice.
And it was just so – but the Wi-Fi was on and off. So I just kind of put it on hold. Then we were moving back to Japan and so. But I may get it going again.
So it's called an Epic Education. And where all of you lived now since where you started in Japan? Mm-hmm. Just give us the rundown.
Okay.
Well, your crazy, awesome, cool life.
I left the States in 1997.
Okay.
You and I, which we may get into, were college buddies at UGA.
Yeah, we'll get into that.
And I graduated in 94 and I taught elementary school for 3 years.
Okay, that's right.
And I was teaching, I taught in South Florida and then I taught in South Atlanta.
That's right, I remember
and
that.
And I was getting a little stressed out. I was, you know, I was intentionally working in whatever at-risk neighborhoods, for lack of a better word.
Were you teaching art?
I was the art teacher.
Okay.
So I saw all the kids in the school. But I was, at least in Florida, I was having chairs thrown at me.
And, wow.
You know, got stabbed with a colored pencil and the scissors once or twice, you know. And so, which, I mean, I chose that job. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be the, you know, the hero of Dangerous Minds or something. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? But after 3 years, I was getting... I needed a break.
Yeah.
This is pre-internet, you know.
Right.
And I heard people taught English abroad, so I went to Taiwan. Actually, I'll truncate this story. So I went to Taiwan, taught English there for a few years, then moved to Tokyo and lived there for 13 years and moved in from business English teaching into – I got a job with a newspaper and then an ad agency.
Right.
And then
your wife is Japanese, just so
my wife is Japanese.
We
met here. She was a school teacher in Atlanta, and she sends her regards.
Good.
She wanted me to tell you hello.
I haven't seen her in so long.
It's been a while. It's been a minute, maybe since 1999.
We'll talk.
I don't know if we want to talk about that. But but anyway, so basically I moved to Taiwan and then she followed me back. Mm-hmm. She left the States and came over. And then we moved together to Tokyo. We lived there for 13 years.
Yeah, I knew you were there for a long time.
A long time. And that's where the kids were born.
Right.
And then in 2013, I was working for an ad agency. She was working for a bank, and we just didn't see our kids anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We called ourselves tag team single parents.
Oh, that sucks.
Because, you know, I would pick them up one night, and she would come home at 11, and then she would pick them up the next night, and I would come home at 11. So we wanted to make a change. So I worked out something with my company to work remotely, which is a whole story in itself that I'll spare you now. And we started kind of moving around. And
right.
We went back to Taiwan to show the kids, you know, this place that we loved so much.
Uh-huh.
And then Chiang Mai, Thailand, and then Malaysia. And that was 2 months each. It was too fast. And so then we went back to Malaysia. We lived in Malaysia for a year.
Uh-huh.
And then we went to Spain and lived in Valencia, Spain for 2 years.
Uh-huh. That must have sucked.
Yeah, it was terrible. And then we went to Mexico. And we started in the Yucatan Peninsula for a few months, and it didn't really click. And then we went to the sort of the, what do you call it, the high plains in central Mexico, a place called San Miguel de Allende.
Right.
And ended up staying there for almost 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And that brings us up to this summer. And this summer we moved back to Japan. This time we're in Osaka.
Mm-hmm.
Keiko, my wife's family, is in Osaka. And the kids, this is sort of the last chance for them to experience living in Japan.
So this is home for you guys. Does it feel like home, Japan?
Osaka doesn't, even though I've been there at least once or twice a year since 1997 to see my wife's family. But we wanted to kind of live there. I was thrilled to be back in Japan after the time away.
Yeah.
I love living in Japan. I didn't like working in Japan.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? I didn't like the kind of hours and stuff that I was having to put in. But, you know, the kids' first language is Japanese and they can't speak it now.
Really?
I mean, the boy's all right. The girl can barely speak. But they're fluent in Spanish and they're fluent in English, which they weren't when we left.
Interesting.
They were not – I mean, they could speak, but they couldn't read or write on their level. So we kind of – we left and worked on their English, and then we moved to Spain and we put them in local Spanish schools where they made friends. And then And same thing in Mexico. So they're, you know, and they just didn't identify with that side of themselves.
Yeah.
So we wanted to go back. Or that's one of many reasons. But the boy's going to graduate in 2 years, and he's, you know, he's going to go off to college. So this is
where's he thinking? Does he know yet?
He has no idea.
America or?
He's looking at some places in the States. We're okay. going to do a couple college tours. We'll go to California in the spring, and then
so
come
nuts,
to the East
man.
Coast in the summer.
Uh-huh.
And then he still has a bunch of buddies in Spain and
right.
various places, and so he may look at Europe, but probably the States. It all depends, you know, on a variety of factors. He's 17. He doesn't know what he wants.
Right, right. So what is it? What's it been like? And what's it been like for your kids? I know, like, to do something like this, everyone's got to be game somewhat.
Right. Right.
How much pushing and pulling was there, or is it like you would think it is in a movie where everyone's just like, great, Dad, where are we going to – what's the next adventure?
Oh, I wish it was like that.
Like, what are the ups and downs and the benefits and the bad things?
There's definitely been there's been pros and cons. I think the pros are our kids were, you know, sheltered in a way, almost like Japanese kids, right? You know,
because
that's where they grew up. And they're much more self-confident and resourceful. They can handle themselves. I mean, we just let our 16 – when he was 16, he backpacked through Europe this summer.
Wow.
On his own. So, or,
wow.
Well, with a bunch of friends, but
but
a bunch of other 17, 18-year-old kids.
Man, that's awesome.
And so, you know, he can kind of swing that kind of stuff, and he can manage a lot of different things. And our girl, you know, she's got it together in a lot of ways. The downside of that is that they were just tired of moving around eventually.
Right.
You know, I mean, they were meeting friends.
That's
basically
tough,
when we moved to Mexico, it was like, can we stop moving around? We want to stay in one place for a while.
And when that happens, is it like, as parents, you got to heed that
sure.
request?
You know, their feedback, you know, is a big part of it.
Yeah.
You know? And so, but, you know, and so we thought Mexico might be that. And it was great for the time that we were there, but the schools weren't really prepping the boy for college the
okay.
way we wanted.
Right.
And also at the same time, we realized that they couldn't speak Japanese and this was the last chance, so we decided to go back. So when he graduates in whatever it is, 2021, I guess, we'll, you know, he'll head off and then we'll decide, you know, our daughter has a vote in like,
right.
are we going to stay in Japan? Are we going to move somewhere else? We can move to the States. It'll be, you know, she'll be in that feedback.
So. Are you ever going to live in the States again?
I don't know.
I felt like
maybe.
I feel like when you left all those years ago, when you left, I felt like this is it. Jenkins is never going to come back.
I hadn't thought about moving back in a long time. But it depends on where my kids are. If they wanted to move here,
sure, you want to be
then,
close to them.
You know, I'd want to be a little close to them. Yeah. Yeah,
so that makes
we'll
sense.
I mean, it all depends on what's going on in the States as well, but I haven't written it off.
Right,
it's not my first choice right now. I'm happy to be back in Japan for a while.
What is your family thought about all of this?
Well, I mean, they thought like I thought when I left, I was going for a year.
Right,
I mean, that's all I was going to go.
So I was the only one that knew that you were coming back.
Yeah, Nostradamus over here. Yeah, they thought I was going to leave for a year, and I did too.
Uh-huh.
And then I was like, I'm not ready to come back, and I stayed. And, you know, so probably the first 5 years, they were like, when are you going to come back? And then they realized I'm probably not.
Right.
So
they got
or at
right
least not anytime soon.
Uh-huh.
So, but it's been tough. You know, I mean, I'm the only kid with grandkids, right?
Right.
My sister never had kids. My brother may not, I don't know, but he doesn't have any yet. So, you know, for my parents, it's been kind of tough. So, I mean, you were talking about sort of the downside.
Yeah.
You know, I adore my parents, and it, you know, it hurts them
right.
to do that. May I take off my shirt?
Yeah,
it's a little warm.
Do whatever you want.
Thanks.
You can take off all your clothes, Jason.
Ooh, mercy Lord.
I've seen that body before.
Right on.
So what would you like to tell people to seek out of yours?
Huh, what would I want them to see of mine?
Because I know there are a lot of people, I know for sure we have listeners that live in Japan right now, some really active movie crushers.
Oh,
and,
right.
And I know that there are people that are interested in doing things like this, and I think people can be scared away from it.
Mm-hmm.
It's intimidating.
Sure.
And I think you could be a good resource for encouraging this kind of lifestyle.
Sure. Well, you know, maybe before I say, you know, where to point people towards, when you say you have friends or listeners in Japan, let me just tell you that you have listeners all over the place. I have bumped into people in multiple countries. I thought I wrote you about that. Maybe I didn't, but I've had people in multiple countries. You know, when you start talking about podcasts, they're like, oh, have you heard of this one, Stuff You Should Know? And I'm like, yeah, I actually know that guy. And they don't just say, oh, you know that guy. They go, you know Chuck Bryant?
That's so funny.
Yeah. I've had people come at my sister's wedding in Mexico. Somebody like basically pushed everybody out of the room.
I think you told me about that
one. And came up to me. And let me just take a moment to say, I'm thrilled for you, man.
Thanks, dude.
We would have never – how do I put this? You know, I would have never predicted that this would have been your career path, but of course not. We didn't even know what a podcast was in 94.
Yeah, no one.
But to see, you know, the kind of success you've had sort of, you know, being able to do something you love, I love it. I'm really happy for you.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, right.
And
on.
I for you. So we met – well, tell people where to find you.
Oh, just my website is www.anepic.com. Education.com. Mm-hmm. The podcast, all the podcast episodes are there. And then I've got a lot of pieces on, you know, saving money or how to do this or
right.
how to deal with flights with kids on long term and travel gear and hotels.
Schooling.
And a lot of, you know, we've done, maybe didn't mention that, but, you know, we've done homeschooling. We pulled our kids. Our kids were in local schools in Japan when mm-hmm. we left. And then as we moved around, we did homeschooling or we would put them in local schools in various places. We've done a variety of different things. And I've written about it and kind of given tips on our experience. And we made a ton of mistakes, so people can learn from those. But, but yeah, there's, you know, where to stay, what to take with you and what not to take with you.
Right.
And then the podcast is just a different traveling family. Some articles are about traveling with little kids and others are about a specific destination. Uh-huh. They're all over the place. And so if I fire it back up, I may give it a more focus on one particular thing because it was kind of all over the place. But
are you on Twitter or anything?
I am. That's NEPIC.edu.
All right. Because I think you would be comfortable if people hit you up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Personally for questions and stuff
sure. A lot of people write into the blog. Maybe I should say a lot of people lately have been writing in about the Spanish residency visa because I wrote these long pieces because it was a saga to get that as an American citizen.
Right.
You know, when you're EU, you can stay. So a lot of people write me about that and I'm happy to help if I can, but Spain bureaucracy is always changing.
Really?
You'll get a different answer in every office. So a lot of people write me on questions that they're already in the post somewhere.
Yeah.
Or I can't really answer it because this was my experience 3 years ago.
Right,
and
exactly.
It may have changed. So if you're listening right now and you want to move to Spain and you want to get the permanent residency or you want to get your kid into FIFA football like my son did, I'm happy to help if I can, but I may not have the answer because
awesome.
The rules are changing all the time.
Yeah. And what is your job right now? What are you doing, actually?
Just the blog.
Oh, really?
Just the blog. Yeah.
All right, that's great.
For a couple years, I was working part-time, you know, when I was talking about arranging something with my job. I worked for an agency in Tokyo, and I was just a glorified copywriter.
Didn't you work for Nikon?
Well, that was our client.
Gotcha.
So, you know, a lot of camera brochures up until 2013, if you looked at a DSLR brochure.
You wrote that shit?
That was me. Yeah.
That's awesome.
I did. Well, basically it's translated and then I kind of, it would depend on the camera. You know, I would have to sort of massage the text for, because it was all, you know, translated by camera nerds and engineers. And so, it's entry level. I have to write this the way a housewife would want to read it. And the pro, I have to write it the way the pros were.
Right.
And so, I got to go on some commercial shoots. That's how I met you that last time when at the premiere at the Center of Puppetry Arts.
Oh,
do you remember that?
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I was coming back from Costa Rica.
That's
we
right.
were shooting a commercial with Moose Peterson, this nature photographer. But I'm getting lost track of time. So that's what I used to do.
Uh-huh.
And then when I proposed to them to not come in the office anymore, there was a whole lot of my job that I couldn't do.
What do you think about me not showing up?
Exactly. So I basically just – I proposed cut my salary in half
and
let's see how this works. And it worked for three and a half, I guess, of the last 6 years.
That's good.
Yeah, which was great. And then, Nikon, Canon, all of them are getting hammered because everybody uses their phones now.
I know.
So,
man.
So their budgets got lower, and my boss, who was a friend, he's like, I don't know how much longer I can go. I said, it's all right. You know, you let me go when right. you need. But by that point, you know, we were using some of our savings and using yeah. money that the blog was coming in. I mean, we're not rolling in dough by any means. And anybody who has questions about this, you make a lot of sacrifices
yeah.
to live this way.
Sure. You know?
So that was a big part of it, for
That's
sure.
That's awesome, man. I have so much respect for the move, or the moves that you've made. And
well, thanks, man.
Doing something different. I think like growing up watching movies like about these like the Mosquito Coast and these kind of
right,
it's always
right,
presented
right.
in films as these crazy dads.
well, yeah. And, I mean fit there's the profile a profile in some way.
There may be a little bit of that, but it's also so rooted in practical things. Like you still have to educate your kids.
Right.
You
right.
still gotta get the job if you know in different places and
it's a lot easier to do that if you're single or you're yeah. just a young couple. But when you got kids, you got
to
make
with
sure
the family,
that
yeah, man.
You got to make sure they have a place to sleep. Well,
right.
I mean, if it was Keiko and I,
and
you
just
know,
to feel secure,
we would stay in dingy little places and
right.
save every dollar for
yeah.
you know, some big ticket items. But you can't do that, you
right?
Know? You got to be able to.
It's really cool, man.
Yeah,
so cool. So we met in college, and I was telling Emily the story last night. We got hired on the same day. We started on the same day at Mexicali Grill.
Mexicali Grill.
Chip Boys.
Most esteemed title I've ever held, I think.
Yeah. I didn't know that it was going to be such a fortuitous thing, not only meeting you, but the things that have happened in my life because of that job, that
right.
dumb job.
Right.
I met you, and through you, I met Clay, who's
right.
still one of my great friends.
Yep, mine too.
Through Clay and you, I met Bill, who's still one of my great friends.
Same.
Through that job, I met Justin.
Right.
Still one of my best friends.
Yeah, yeah.
Through Justin, I met Timmy, still one of my great friends.
Right, right, right.
Meredith Extet. You remember Meredith, right?
Of course, yeah, yeah.
We're in touch. Like, we lost touch for a long time, but we're now back in great touch.
Wow.
See her when I go to New York. The list goes on. It's like that weird Mexican restaurant.
Like non-existent now, right?
Yeah.
It's gone.
It's gone.
But that is just amazing how one—
It's crazy, man. Like what would have happened had I not gone in there for that job that
right.
summer?
Right.
And then through meeting you, so here's the thanks of gratitude. I was coming out of high school as a Baptist boy.
Okay.
Sort of starting to explore different thoughts and pathways in life and— alternate ways of looking at the world that
right.
weren't just through the church. Mm-hmm. You are a preacher's kid.
I am.
Who got a head start on that stuff. and preacher's kids, like, there's one of a few ways you can go. I think you can really rebel mm-hmm. and be bad.
Right.
You can super follow in the footsteps. Mm-hmm. Or you can kind of go in that middle area, which is, I think, where you went.
I guess you could
say
that.
To a certain degree.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I rebelled a lot and did lots of stupid stuff, but I'm still comfortable in their world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not my world for, you know, lack of a better phrase,
right.
but I'm still completely comfortable. I go, I go to church with them when I come back.
Right.
And
you don't feel like your skin is burning?
No. Not anymore anyway. But I adore them. They walk the walk. They live the life that—
Your parents are great.
They're awesome.
Yeah.
And they live the life that, you know, that they profess everyone should live.
Right.
And I admire them for that.
Yeah,
for sure.
they're good people. And so you had a bit of a head start on sort of everything that I caught up to later, and you really like— you sent me on a different path more so than anyone else.
Did I?
You did.
Okay.
Musically, I mean, there's a laundry list of things I could list
that
turned me on to. Like,
uh-huh.
You're the one who came over and said, fucking, we're watching Reservoir Dogs tonight. I saw this movie.
That was me.
I don't know if you remember that.
Right,
but you're
right.
Like, you guys just get your shit and come over.
Uh-huh.
And that's fine. Okay. And watch that movie for the first time with you. You introduced me to Jim Jarmusch. You introduced me to Miles Davis. You introduced me to—
That's my proudest moment right
the
there.
The Flaming Lips and the Butthole Surfers and Salvador Dali and the Church of the Subgenius. And like—
Oh, what a great list.
I don't— Yeah, no, I could keep going. But I don't think you realize at the time, because we were just kids—
Right.
—that I was just this sponge soaking up whatever you threw my way.
Right.
And I don't think I realized till later what a big impact that had on me, because
that make me cry. That's so
it was
sweet.
Amazing, man. That sent me in a direction. And you always did it in a way that was like, it was never, oh, you haven't heard of this, or
right. That sort of snobby, like,
yeah, man, it was
I knew
always
it before you kind of thing.
You've always had this joy about it all. And like, oh, man, I can't wait to play you some bebop music, or you've got to see this movie. Because right. You will love it, not because like, oh,
I always
well,
wanted to share with my friends. I was like, man, you got to see this.
It was just,
I mean, it was annoying, I'm sure, sometimes.
No,
but.
It was always amazing. Just really opened my eyes to a lot of stuff. And I, like, honestly, owe you a huge debt. So,
wow.
Thank
wow.
you, man.
Well, oh, man, the pleasure is all mine.
And I miss your recommendation, so we need to get that dialogue going again.
Yeah, sure. I'm not as in the loop, you know, by any means as I used to be. Well, I know, I like what I like, but...
It doesn't have to be the coolest new hip band, you know.
Right. Well, basically, you know, I used to write for the Japan Times about, you know, various music. And it was an easy way to get into shows for free or meet bands that I liked. You know, I got to call Diplo and Interpol and all, you know,
that's right.
All that kind of stuff.
Because you were shooting a lot of those festivals and...
Yeah. Well, I was working at the Fuji Rock Festival.
Right,
I managed the English language team for that. I got Clay a job on that one time when he came to
visit. That's right. I remember that.
It was fun. But about the when I stopped writing about that, I still explore new music for sure,
yeah.
Movies, but not with the kind of rabid
I don't either.
Views. You know, maybe
you
I
get
can't
busy.
Remember if it was, I can't remember if it was David Letterman interviewing Conan O'Brien or the other way around, but Letterman talked about when he was ready to quit.
Mm-hmm.
It was like when he came home and his wife or his kid asked him, like, who was on the show tonight? And he was like, I don't remember.
So you knew
and,
that was it.
Well, I think I was like that with music. I was just consuming
and
not, you know, and then just, you know, going out and grabbing more. And
right.
Now I'm kind of cherishing. See, I've been gone for 20 years. So when I come back, I like to listen to whatever the classic rock station
right.
here or V103. It's like, oh, my God, it's Creedence Clearwater Revival. I haven't heard that forever.
That in Japan.
Kids, have you ever heard this? You know, they have no clue. You
That's
know?
So funny.
So it's fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I always told myself that I'm never going to stop seeking out new, like, independent music.
Same.
And I kind of have in a lot of ways.
Have you? Right.
Because you know how it is. You get busy. But I still try and – at the end of the year, I'll read end-of-year list of people I trust.
Right.
And I'll pick out a few things.
Sure.
It's just not quite as much.
Yeah.
But I still go to live music all the time.
Do you? Are you still playing? You got a band, right?
Yeah, we still play.
Awesome.
Yeah,
awesome.
We're having
with,
a lot of fun.
With Ed and Chris Cox.
And Jim Issa is the drummer.
Oh, right. Okay, very cool.
I don't know if you ever met Jim.
I know the name because he's in that same circle, but I haven't.
He's
I haven't
a friend from high school. So
oh, right. Okay.
It's like all these friends, we all ended up living like within 4 or 5 miles of each other in Atlanta.
Right.
After many of us going in many different directions for many years.
Right.
We all, because, you know, I kind of lost touch with Clay for a while and Bill.
Oh, right. Sure.
And we've all kind of converged, you know, as adults here, and it's
fantastic.
Great.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of us have kids, and it's great. I'd love to hang out with your kids at some point.
Yeah, it'd be great.
Because Bill's daughter, Wyatt, is awesome, and
she
hang out with her some, and it's kind of this 2.0 phase that's, I mean, your kids are graduating now, but it's fun now having our kids be friends with each other.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's just a really something to be cherished, I think, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
And fostered.
Hmm.
Like, I don't like that we've lost touch as much as we have.
No, we haven't now.
Right.
We're back.
Exactly. I'm glad I got to thank you in person.
No, hey.
I was going to send it in an email one time.
That's humbling. Thank you.
I have
thank
on here you. Reservoir Dogs, Flaming Lips, Jesus Lizard, Miles Davis.
Jesus Lizard.
Well, Miles
That's my
Davis.
Gym music now.
Miles Davis opened up the whole jazz world.
Right.
So that, like,
right.
It's not just Miles. Church of Subgenius, Diggable Planets. I think that's it as far as the list goes.
Mm-hmm.
You knew Chuck Johnson passed away, didn't you? Did you hear that?
You wrote me. You wrote me
about
that.
Oh, okay. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's how I found out.
Yeah. So,
I don't know what happened, but I adored that guy, so.
I think he had an aneurysm and just dropped dead alone.
Okay. That's horrible.
I know. It was terrible. Chuck was one of our fellow waiters. Chuck was the first really good gay friend that I had.
Yeah.
That's why everyone from those days still call me Chucky. Because there was already Chuck that worked there.
Right, there was already a Chuck.
So a lot of those Mexicali people still call me Chucky on Facebook and stuff. Meredith Eckstead still calls me Chucky.
Does she? Right,
yes,
right,
after
right,
all
right,
these
right.
years. But it was really sad to lose Chuck, and I was trying to get together a little reunion, and Didn't get around to it, but that's something that we should probably do at some point.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to see all those guys.
Should we talk?
Yeah, sure.
Being there?
Let's do it.
I watched it last night. This is the Hal Ashby film from 1979, obviously starring the great Peter Sellers, who Indeed. I just got his a biography 2 days ago. Uh-huh. Showed up in the mail. That I know is just going to ruin everything because he was kind of a monster.
Apparently so. He was like, you know, borderline personality disorder.
Yes. Kind
of. I don't know if he was always that way or if it was like that near the end.
No, I think he was always that way.
Okay.
And
okay.
A really tough person in real life and admitted, I mean, one of the reasons I did a lot of research on this one, self-admitted fan of Chance or Chauncey Gardner in this role mm-hmm. because he felt like he identified with him as an empty vessel.
An empty vessel, yeah. I read something like that too.
Yeah. And he was very well known for no one really knowing who Peter Sellers was because he was always in character.
He always fell into some role and then didn't really come out of it until the next one came along, right?
But not a good husband, not a good father. Mm. And I wanted to read this book because I'm such a fan of his work, and I know what's going to be in there,
right?
And it's not going to be pretty, but I'm going to read it anyway.
Well, this is one of my favorite movies, but I can't say I'm some Peter Sellers aficionado or something like that.
Right.
I love the Pink Panther movies because I love to watch my dad laugh, during those. I mean, the
Dude,
slapstick.
I thought there was nothing funnier when I was a kid than the
same,
Pink
same.
Panther.
I mean, I laugh, but my dad has one of those laughs that just is contagious.
Yeah,
So we even watch those now.
Uh-huh.
But I wasn't a fan of Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, I saw it once a long time ago. It was too slow paced, and I never watched it again. Now that I've kind of done this research and watched this movie,
I bet you'd
times,
like it now.
I'd probably like it now.
Yeah.
But being there was something about it that I connected with.
Mm-hmm.
And then I watched it, and we'll probably get into sort of the sort of analogies that are made for it today and in the past. But I watched it maybe 10 years ago during the W years and thought, you could put this movie out.
Right.
You could put this movie out tomorrow.
Yeah.
And if the film quality and the clothes didn't give it away, it would look like it was just made yesterday. I'm sure there'll be some part of that. We get into that. But, out of all the movies, you told me to send you some movies.
Yeah.
And I looked at my list, and it's the only sort of quiet, subtle movie. All my other favorite movies are bombast. Indiana Jones and Baron Munchausen and Iron Monkey and all this sort of in your face. And then there's Being There, which is this kind of singular, subtle gem, but it still connects. I watched it, a week or so ago.
Yeah, it's so
before
good.
Before this, and it's just as good as it was then.
I totally agree. My entree into this film was, believe it or not, the Mad Magazine parody.
Really?
Yeah. So I don't know if you're into Mad, but I was a nut for Mad Magazine growing up.
Okay.
And they had their big film parodies. It was, I think, usually two each issue.
Okay.
Where they would parody a film, and I remember it was called Being Not All There. And
appropriate.
Read that before I saw the movie because I was, I was a little kid, a 9-year-old, didn't go see Being There.
Mm-hmm.
And then saw the movie years later. But it's funny. I had a few of those where Matt, like us, the Exorcist spoof and the Amityville Horror spoof.
I'll have to look into that.
And a bunch of those that I saw like way before I saw the films.
Before you saw the film.
Oh,
that's classic.
Absolutely.
Well, maybe this is the right point to say another unique thing I find about Being There is, well, let me back up and say, once we decided on doing Being There,
right?
I grabbed the book and I read it.
Okay. You did?
Well, audio book, but it's a very short book. It's only like 250 pages.
Uh-huh.
The audio book itself was like 3 hours. I mean, I listened to it on a trip, on a trip to Kyoto and back.
I'm going to have to check that out.
It's really good, and it would be one of the only books or one of the only kind of stories I could say that I would recommend reading it after seeing it.
Oh, okay.
I hate to read a book after I see the movie.
Yeah.
Even after the trailer, because the characters are burned in, and I don't formulate my own characters.
Right.
I see the faces.
Yep.
But the story is smaller. That's another unique thing. The they actually flesh the story out. There's characters that don't exist in the story in the book. You know, there's whole sort of subplots and little extra jokes. And the ending, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, is not in the book.
Right. I think I knew that because I saw that it was not in the original screenplay. In the original screenplay, the Eve and Chauncey find each other in the woods.
Right.
And just get in a car and leave.
Right.
Is that how it happens in the book?
If I remember correctly, it was just like he's, you know, there's people in like the smoky back room political, you know, trying to figure out who's going to run for president. Right. And they're talking about him and he just kind of walks out a door.
Yeah.
Where in the movie, I'm sure we'll get to this, you know, it's the funeral and the pallbearers are kind of whispering it as he kind of wanders off into the woods.
Such
and
a great
has
way
his
to play
strange
it.
Possibly Christ-like moment. Yeah. I don't know. It's like, you know, that's that. I definitely want to, you know, get to that because I would love to know how you feel about that ending.
We'll put but a
the
pin
book
in
is,
that.
But the book is great. It's read by Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, interesting.
Which I wondered if this was chosen because I, you know, doing my research, somebody was saying maybe Chauncey Gardner, and I'm assuming if you're listening to this. You either read the book or you saw the movie or you're bored already. But you know, he's this sort of dim-witted guy. Uh-huh. And somebody was saying maybe he was autistic or something.
Yeah.
Whether that's true or not. But having Dustin
diagnosis.
Hoffman reading the
you know,
the book was sort of a strange a strange twist. But highly recommended.
Yeah. It's interesting because we don't know what the diagnosis is.
Right.
And to see this through a modern lens is much different than when it was made in 1979.
Sure.
You would just – well, the whole premise of the movie is that no one understands that he has any sort of affliction.
Exactly.
I guess that back then they would have called him slow or something.
Right, right. Or but nobody picks up on that.
That's no one picks up on it. That's the whole premise of the movie.
Right.
Is
that people see what they want to see.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the running theme. Yeah. Real quick on Hal Ashby.
Okay.
He owned the 70s, maybe like no other director owned the 70s.
Yeah.
This was his run. Harold and Maude in 71, The Last Detail in 73, Shampoo in 75, Bound for Glory in 76, Coming Home in 78, and then being there in 79.
Boom.
I don't know if like any other director can claim a run like that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 like classic films by anyone's standard inside a 10-year period. And then I don't know how much you know about him. He kind of went off the deep end.
Yeah, yeah. I think he kind of fell off the radar in his own head, too.
Yeah, and got really bad into heroin and cocaine.
Oh, right.
And was sort of looked at as unhirable for a while and tried to get back in the game late. And I think made one more movie that didn't do so well. But had this great run, and then that was sort of it.
And there's a little parallel with Peter Sellers himself there, right? He
for
made
sure.
only one more movie before his death, and it was some lame, like, Fu Manchu. It was like the curse of Fu Manchu or something like that.
I remember that
which
movie.
Was a nothing burger.
And, yeah.
But he made, you know, one of the best films, one of my favorite films.
Absolutely.
At the very end of his career with Hal Ashby doing the same thing.
Yeah, I think he was sort of problematic for his personality problems.
Mm-hmm.
This at this point in his career,
right
after really cleaning up in the sort of 60s and early 70s.
And it sounds like it was Peter Sellers that actually was pushing Ashby to make this movie. He read this book by a guy named Jerzy Kosinski. I'm probably butchering that name, but he read the book and spent like 8 years pushing Ashby to make this movie. And and it's a gem.
Yeah, and I think Hal Ashby wanted full control and got some deal with a group called Lorimar Pictures. And I think they're the ones that ended up kind of wrecking his reputation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not exactly sure why, because this was a critical hit. It was a financial hit.
Mm-hmm.
It did really well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like they had any, you know, egg on their face for doing this. So I'm not sure what the deal was. Maybe it was like interpersonal stuff. But and, you know, we don't have to go, like, in order of the movie. We can kind of jump around.
Sure.
I guess we should just talk about the sort of the way he played this role. Like, the physicality and the voice was just so spot on, and he just inhabits his character so well.
I wonder, yeah, like I wonder if he's one of those method guys that would have stayed like that.
Because, he did.
Yeah, that's kind of shocking, you know. And watching that makes me rethink the autism thing. I guess it's on my mind. I just read this book last year called, I wish I could remember the name of the author. It's like The Curious Incident of the Dog at Night. Have you heard of this book?
Mm-mm.
It's a play and a book. It's a real quick read, but it's written from the perspective of an autistic teenager in mm-hmm. Britain. And he's trying to solve the crime of, like, the dog across the street was murdered. And basically, you know, almost, not, you know, for a normal person, nothing almost happens. He takes a train and to
right.
go see his mother. But it's written in this way, thinking the way he thinks.
Oh,
and
interesting.
Rewatching, I could see this – I could see a little bit of Chauncey Gardner.
Yeah.
But this idea, this character that had never left the walled garden,
yeah,
and was so obsessed with television,
mm-hmm.
and there was a lot of parts that I remember of him that would then show up later where, you know, he would be imitating
yeah.
something that happened on television,
uh-huh.
and then at just the right moment, at the right chance. I mean, this
right.
sort of, you know, the whole idea of being there and the little moment of chance was just it was so well timed.
Yeah, everything from the way he and you'll see him, you know, hone in on something on the television,
mm-hmm.
and you almost at a certain point you start to get what's going on. You know that's going to come back,
right?
Like the way he shakes hands.
And
when he first met the president,
mm-hmm.
Jack Warden, who was fucking phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
the
yeah.
way he shakes his hand so like vigorously, both hands, and Jack Warden can't get his hands away from him.
Or the way, you know, he sees some stagecoach driver
uh-huh.
tip his hat, and then later he tips his hat. And
yeah.
then or right at the right moment when the woman who's in love with him comes in and
uh-huh.
he sees somebody kissing on television.
Right.
And
he does it the same way.
Oh, can we just stop for a moment to like some of the little TV moments
uh-huh.
are so brilliant.
Yeah.
And I kind of remember them from, you know, from
sure.
my childhood. There was like the you can call me Ray and you can call
oh,
me
yeah.
Jay.
Ray
and,
then, uh-huh.
and there was the Basketball Jones at, you know,
yeah,
little video.
Dude.
You know who did that?
Uh-uh.
That's Cheech and Chong, man.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Which it doesn't make
right.
sense. I rewatched it. It doesn't sound like them. But when you look at credits, it's Cheech
wow,
and Chong.
Wow. Basketball Jones.
Yeah. But that little, you know, weird kind of cartoon. And but yeah. then there's stuff like Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers
uh-huh.
and, you know, Peppermint Patty commercials and all these weird
yeah.
little things. And a lot of times I liked how they would kind of clue in, like in the Basketball Jones, it's saying, you know, I need someone to stand beside me. And it's paralleling this woman who's
yes.
sitting right next to him. And so,
yeah, there were a lot of sly little things like
yeah,
that.
There was a lot of little found objects that sort of
uh-huh.
really kind of mirror the situation in a subtle way.
Yeah, so he's in Washington, D.C. in at the very beginning of the movie, which is another parallel that'll play out in his second life at the Biltmore Estate in North Carolina.
Right.
Which, have you ever been there?
I haven't, but it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's something else. Yeah. You should check it out at some point.
That's another difference in the book is the book takes place in New York City.
Right.
And
not
so this
DC.
Is, and in the summertime. But
okay.
so the movie's actually better with the winter and the
yeah.
sort of like and the, you know, the political climate. I thought that was great.
Well,
but
he
then
gets
those
to wear his overcoat and the umbrella and the whole
exactly,
look, you know,
exactly.
sort of complete.
He can complete that look for sure.
But he, you know, the old man, which is what he calls him, whoever
uh-huh.
has owned this house that he's lived in as the gardener, the old man has died.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to leave the house. And that very early scene where the two I guess real estate attorneys or whatever they
right,
are,
right?
Basically, tell them, you know, you got to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to try and make a claim against the estate? And that sets up the whole recurring thing with the claim, like
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't want to make a claim.
Mm-hmm.
But he, it's interesting to look at that today. Like this was the 70s; they were basically like, this guy clearly needs help, and they
right.
just toss him out on his ass. Today, there would be someone to help him. They would put him in touch with
right. There would be a social network or
absolutely
some support network. I think is
some
what I
kind of
say.
Support network to get him going.
Mm-hmm.
A caseworker, a social worker, something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny to look back at the 70s when they're like, "Oh, this guy who was like, you know, obviously has some, at the very least, some pretty big learning disabilities."
Right.
You're out on your ass in the middle of Washington, D.C.
And credit to, I mean, the music choice there when they are playing the 2001 theme.
The discoed up version?
Diodato is his name. I can't remember. It's like a Brazilian. He was like a contemporary of Chick Corea and all these guys. Human Diodato or something. Uh-huh. Like this sort of Latin disco 2001.
It's pretty great.
Which, you know, is sort of, you know, was a probably a nod, you know, to the movie itself.
Yeah, sure. Kubrick.
As he's sort of emerging uh-huh. into the world.
Absolutely.
And it was classic. I've actually been listening to it since.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's funky as hell, man. It was nice.
Yeah, it's a nice jam.
And then there's one of the most, and I think it sort of was played for laughs in 1979, but watching it last night, it was such a heartbreaking scene when he meets the sort of street toughs.
Right.
And the guy flicks a switchblade in his face. And he tries to change the channel. He picks up his remote control and points it at the guy and clicks it.
So sad, but
so
kind of funny.
Sad. It's kind of funny, but in 79, I'm sure it was like a laugh riot.
Right.
I'm watching it as a 48-year-old man in 2019 or 20.
Right.
And I just wanted to start crying because this guy has never been faced with reality.
Right.
And he's trying to change the channel
also,
something that's scary.
Also not in the book. That whole part. And I got a fact for you, the little trippy out here, too. That kid?
Oh, no.
The kid that's like, you tell that chicken shit motherfucker that I'm going to blah, 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 blah. You know, like, that guy, his name is Oteil Burbridge, and he was the bassist for a band called Aquarium Rescue Unit.
What?
Yeah. I have no idea.
Wow.
For the listeners, Aquarium Rescue Unit was one of the only kind of jam band types that I got into.
Yeah, who was it? Colonel Bruce Hampton.
Colonel Bruce Hampton.
Yeah.
Colonel Bruce Hampton looked like your high school gym coach. He had this big Tom Selleck mustache and wore like gym
beer belly.
Shorts
and
a beer belly. And then he had this freakazoid band with like some, you know, weird hippie guitarist and then had this fishbone-ish looking bassist guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he looked
I think he turned me on to fishbone too, by the way.
Ah, right.
Now that you mention it.
I'm proud of that. But anyway, and there he is. And I don't know, I knew that before I looked it up on IMDb, but I went to confirm it before I told you that. But these guys played at the, you know, Georgia Theater and a variety of places when we were in college. Why the hell he's in being there?
I know.
I have no clue. And I have no idea what he's doing now.
Local DC kid.
Maybe he was. Maybe he was.
You also turned me on to Bad Brains, speaking of DC.
Oh, dude. Yeah. Bad Brains.
These are going to keep popping up
now. I saw them in
now.
Japan a while back.
Oh, really?
They're old, man. This is a while back, means maybe 5 or 6
not,
years
not
ago.
Not so great.
They're not doing backflips on stage anymore.
Yeah. None of us are, Jinky. He leaves the house and then has a very fortuitous thing happens. He gets backed into by a car of the wife of a very rich and influential man. These days he would be a tech billionaire,
or
I guess.
Hedge fund manager.
Yeah, he's
or
like
one
a
of
Warren
those.
Buffett or something.
He's a Warren
basically.
Buffett type guy.
But has, you know, he's has such influence that he has the ear of the president, played by Jack Warden. The wife is played by Shirley MacLaine, and Melvin Douglas is his new old man.
Right,
and he kind of falls from one situation.
Falls right into
the same goddamn situation.
Yeah, and it, you know, it couldn't have been more perfect that he finds this. And he's even, and that's one of the beautiful things is that he's not deceiving anybody.
No,
he has no idea that they don't know.
Right,
you know. That he doesn't. He thinks he's doing exactly. He's like, oh wow, this is just. You know, now you'll make my lunch. You know, that
absolutely.
Kind of thing. You know, Louise made my lunch, and now you'll make my lunch.
Right,
and this is where. At this point, this is where the sort of comedy of errors, of misunderstandings, and hearing what you want to hear really kick in as he's at dinner and like this army of waiters and butlers are serving them meals and he starts to talk about that, you know, his house closed down and the attorneys closed it down and this, you know, this character, what's his name, Rand, which is a perfect name for this too.
Totally.
You know,
like Rand, the
Rand
Corporation.
Exactly, or, you know, Ayn Rand and all of that. It's perfect. You know, what he hears is not the literalness of what he's saying, but that
You know, and he says, "I want to work in your garden and the gardens and all this." And what this,
all these metaphors.
This hedge fund, yeah, he hears it as metaphors, and that the, you know, the American entrepreneur has to, you know, till the soil and and plant the seeds. And then when he talks about like, all I have is the room, you know, this is Chance talking now, or Chauncey, I should say.
Yeah, because they misunderstand. He says Chance the gardener.
Yeah. In the book, there's Chance and Chauncey. You hear from his, Chance's perspective and Chauncey, which is kind of nice. But in here, he's Chauncey to everyone.
Right.
But, you know, Chauncey says something about that all he has now is the man upstairs.
Yeah.
And that just hits home to him, to this billionaire.
Because he's like, well, I have none of that.
I'll have none of that. I'm going to the man upstairs next.
Yeah.
You know, don't you talk about that. And so it really sets this sort of snowball in motion of just everybody wants him to be their savior, their
sage. It's interesting. There are so many, like, it's a comment on so many things, everything from dum-dum TV culture to politics to people not listening, truly listening to someone and filling in the blanks that they want to hear. I mean, it's a satire. It's not as funny as I remember. It's a pretty dramatic film.
It's dramatic, and rein me in if this is going off on the wrong way. But I'm not a fan of like today's cringe comedy.
Same here.
Curb Your Enthusiasm and all that. I don't dislike it, but it makes me uncomfortable, and I don't enjoy watching it.
No,
I'm not saying I hate all of it, but I don't watch all of it because it's a very uncomfortable situation.
It is.
Well, this movie has that a little bit of that element, but I relish it because I just can't believe what they're thinking.
I think the difference is in something like The Office, which I loved, it's an obnoxious character who's making everyone uncomfortable.
Right.
And this, he is so pure of heart. There's none of that.
Maybe that's it.
He's a good guy. He's honest to a fault, because he knows nothing else.
He
knows is how to talk about the thing right in front of his face, or the thing he knows about, which is gardening
and television.
So good. And then, you know, this budding romance starts to bloom because Rand is a dying man. He has this younger wife
who's desperate for some sort of attention and romance that she's never had.
That's right.
And she sees that in him, and so she doesn't see anything else.
And Shirley MacLaine is so great in this.
Isn't she?
I read some of the behind-the-scenes stuff. Like, Sellers was in character the whole time. She is just a world-class kook and always has been.
Right.
So she was on set talking about her numerology and all her
lives or something.
Past lives. Hal Ashby is there just stoned out of his mind 24/7.
Ashby is what they call him, I think.
Ashby. And apparently it was just like a pretty crazy scene.
I believe it.
On the set of being there. But through all that, you get this very docile, sort of calming film. It has that effect on you when you're watching it, even.
Right. It's calming, and then there'll be these moments where, oh, he's going to get found out right now.
Yeah.
And they somehow, I mean, like the point where he finally sees another black person. And he goes, "Do you know Raphael?"
Right.
And you're like, oh, my God, he's about to give that message. But you don't get that till the credits. You know?
Right. So, which I want to talk about that later, too, actually.
Yeah, sure.
A very controversial
sort of thing.
By the way, the DP as well was Caleb Deschanel, who is Zoe Deschanel's father.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay.
Apparently, Hal Ashby used to work almost exclusively with the great Haskell Wexler, but he was not available, so they went to Caleb Deschanel, which is pretty interesting. He's in this new situation that is just like the old one. People start to find him out a little bit because of two reasons. One, you basically have two people investigating him. You have Secret Service.
Right.
Because of his eventual meeting with the president.
Right.
And all of a sudden this guy's getting quoted on the evening news.
Right.
As this economic sage. And then you have the other group investigating.
Right. The Russians, or you mean the attorneys?
The attorneys.
Right.
And you get the feeling, and the doctor, he's sort of one of those, is sort of like, what's going on with
this guy? He's another added character that's good. There's some person who is sort of suspicious, who's like, this doesn't really match up, and he's great in that movie.
But what's interesting that hit me last night after all the times I've seen this is they are all, I think they think they're after a con man.
Mm-hmm.
They don't come out and really say it, but they're like, something stinks here. Like, this guy's putting one over on us. But like you said earlier, that's not the case.
No.
He is a mystery man.
Right.
And there is a
– no documentation.
There is
no
mystery to be solved.
Right.
But he's not conning anybody.
Right, right, right. There was that great scene where, you know, he has the FBI director and the CIA director. And he's like, all right, this guy, you know, he's got it. You've burned his records. Neither of them know anything, but their own pride stops them from saying we don't know anything because they're like, well, he could be a CIA man. And so in that point, they're not seeing in him what they want to see. It's like literally their own pride is you know, obfuscating their own view, and they can't they can't admit that they don't know.
Right.
So another series of chants where people's own fallacies and their people's own sort of, you know, problems with their own ego, what they want, you know, allow this guy to move forward.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, I know the other investigator that I was thinking was the reporter from the Financial Times or whatever.
Right.
Because he's the first one that calls him, and that's such a great scene, the phone call he gets.
Oh, and he's like, yeah.
He starts doing yoga, basically. Moving the phone away from his ear, like he doesn't even fully understand how a phone works. And this guy's like, are you still there? Are you there?
Uh-huh.
And he like has fully set the phone down because the television is on.
Right, right.
It's like
my
4-year-old.
Right. And he's like, I've been on television because at that earlier scene, he had been.
Right.
Remember when he's like.
That's when he got hit by the car.
He got hit by the car. He was standing there.
Uh-huh.
That was a great moment because 2001 disco version is kind of fading out.
Uh-huh.
And he's standing there and there's like a moon and something behind there to kind of show.
Yeah.
And he sees himself on a video recorder.
Right.
So when they ask him to be on the talk show, he's like, yes, I've been on television.
Again, honest.
Yeah, yeah. He never lies. He never.
Yeah.
He's never anything.
It's
he's
that childlike
not.
Wonder.
Yeah. And at the same time, as he's doing these idiotic things when people are not looking, or you know, just watching television.
Yeah.
And saying these empty platitudes, or well, they're not even platitudes to him. They're just straightforward facts about gardening.
Yeah.
I wrote down some of the things that people were, you know, they called him smart and sensible.
Uh-huh.
They called him level-headed. They said, you don't play games with words, Chauncey.
That's right.
You know, you're direct and straightforward.
Uh-huh.
You know, you have the gift of being natural, you know, and then I feel safe with you.
Yeah.
You know? And then, you know, you seem to be a truly peaceful man.
And those are all true things.
Those are all true, you know, but, and that's another thing about this is that he's never lying and deceiving and,
right.
like, you know, he's not trying to stay one step ahead of them. He's just, which is in a way, I was trying to think of an equivalent to this movie.
Me too.
Where someone's stumbling, I think, and I haven't seen it since I was maybe 10 years old, but like an early Tom Hanks movie where it's like the man with the one red shoe, where it's like,
right.
Everybody, this is just some schmo, but everybody thinks he's some spy or something and he doesn't realize it. But by chance, you know, some things stumble into place. But, you know, aside from that, I can't think of any other thing.
I think Forrest Gump tried to do some of this stuff in a way more obvious.
And ham-fisted.
Ham-fisted way. Yeah. Absolutely. I think it wanted to be it being there in some ways.
Interesting. Yeah. You're not wrong.
You know?
I don't know why I didn't think of that one. Of course. Of course,
but
the sort of slow, mentally challenged guy who stumbles through life
exactly,
and makes history, and everybody loves him and thinks he's a genius.
But this is so much more real and substantial, and like, Hal Ashby played it, and I think he got someone else to help him write the script. Aside from the, someone did a uncredited rewrite or whatever. But
right.
I think they made all the right moves.
Right.
One of my favorite shots early on that I wanted to mention was. Before he even goes to the second old man's house, when he's walking up the median toward the Capitol building.
Brilliant shot, yeah.
With the umbrella and the briefcase or the suitcase or whatever, and the cars are going on both sides of him. And again, it's just that childlike sort of thing. Like, I don't even know if he knows Like he'd never been in a car.
Right.
He said so.
Yep.
I've never been in an automobile.
And he didn't know what an elevator was. And that was one of the great lines is where the butler thinks he's this hilarious guy.
He does.
He's like, how long do we stay in this room?
This is the smallest room in the house. And he's like, oh, yeah, Chauncey. That's the smallest room, right?
Card.
Well, and that part is kind of sad later on when he gets in and the butler just sort of cracks up. And then quickly apologizes and said, I'm sorry. I thought you were going
to tell us one of those great zingers.
Yeah. But he feels bad about it. And I felt bad that he didn't, that he felt bad.
Right, right, right.
You know, it was one of those things because Chauncey couldn't say, like, he just has to
what
sit
joke?
There. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing is,
it's a tough role.
Well, and, you know, I don't think we've got to this directly, but, you know, we've talked about how people see what they want to see.
Mm-hmm.
But he's this sort of distinguished-looking man with a placid face,
mm-hmm.
and he's very well-dressed. He has mm-hmm. good posture, and he speaks slowly and deliberately.
Yeah.
And for most people on the planet, that means authority figure.
Yeah.
And so everybody projects onto him, this is someone with authority.
Uh-huh.
And so that man was trying to he was trying to connect with him. He thought he was going to do one of those jokes, and then suddenly he's like, "Oh, I can't do this I've overstepped the line." And you know, and Chance is just sitting there, has no idea. The first, if I can kind of circle back, right, you know, before he even before he even got into the house, the first time where this happens is where maybe right after the scene you were just talking about, where he walks down the median and he's near the White House or something and he sees a tree.
Right.
And he touches the tree and then he sees a police officer mm-hmm. and says the stupidest – he's like, this tree is sick. We need to help it.
Yeah.
And because he's – if he was a homeless black man
right.
or if it was me or a teenager that said that, you know, that cop would be like, fuck off and get out of here.
Yeah.
But because of the way he looks and the way he's dressed,
that's right.
he literally calls it in.
Uh-huh.
He calls it in.
Yeah.
Because – this guy looks like someone that you have to listen to.
That's right. He could have been a senator or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny you were talking about the authority. There's that great scene later with once he finally gets on TV and he sees some of the reactions of the people from his past.
Right.
And there is the African-American woman who worked with him as, I guess she was like the housekeeper.
Best line of the movie.
Yeah. And she's like, it is a white man's world to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
And that seeing line, man, mm-hmm. this is 1979. And that was so 2020 relevant.
Yeah.
Like you were talking about, so many things I was picking up on that it could have been in like a contemporary film.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she flat out says it. She's like, it is a white man's world.
Yeah.
Like that guy doesn't have two brain cells to rub together.
Oh, no. She said like rice pudding.
Yeah.
Dumb as a jackass. Ain't nothing but rice pudding between his ears.
Oh, that's such a great line.
Yeah.
Rice pudding between his ears.
Dumb as a jackass. I love that. But I don't want to keep doing this, but that is not in the book either.
Oh, okay.
Louise is dead.
Interesting.
In the book.
So he's by himself.
I'm so glad that they brought her in because that whole issue would have not been addressed, and I think is one of the most important parts of the book and one of the most relevant things in the movie that continues on today.
Yeah, I mean, it's a comment on race status and privilege.
Yep.
Oh, just so relevant to today, especially with what's going on in the White House right now.
Yep.
Someone who, I mean, the parallels are there with the television and.
Yeah, when I rewatched this and then I started kind of reading up and there was all these pieces on how it's being there all over again. And at first I kind of pushed back, not that I didn't see it, but I thought, well, there's some significant differences. First, the similarities.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, 45, our president now mm-hmm. is obsessed with television. This guy's obsessed with television.
Yeah.
45 is he says things and tweets things and then people interpret them in different ways and read what they want to read and hear what they want to hear. Those are both there. But of course, our president is sort of really kind of a hateful and sort of
he is a con
man. He's a con man. Whereas, Chance is pure.
Yeah.
He's an innocent. He doesn't even realize he's an innocent.
Yeah.
He doesn't, you know, he's almost not sentient in a way. Do you know what I mean? He's almost like a single cell amoeba that just goes from television to lunch. Louise cooks me lunch, you know?
And it's interesting in the framework of looking at a film character.
Right.
Because a lot of times you either identify or there's something about the character that, like, he plays it so just flat.
Right.
that it's interesting that you root for him. Like you want him to be okay.
Yeah.
But why?
Right. You want him, you know, you're like, you worry that he's about to be found out when it really, yeah. he really should be found out because he could really do damage to the world if somebody he misinterprets could. Something he says.
And he would probably be taken care of in some way.
Yeah.
He would probably be put somewhere.
Right.
But instead he's falling into like, he's like a breath away from the White House by the end of this movie.
Exactly. He's, you know, palling around with the Russian diplomat. And that's another great, you know, misunderstanding or reading what you want to read where the guy's like, you know, I think you must, or he says, we're not too far apart, you and I. And he goes, yes, our chairs are right next to each other, you know. And then the Russian guy spins into this narrative and then he's like, I think you like Krylov's fables. And I looked up Krylov's fables. It was basically a Russian guy who did a lot of sort of, fables. So, you know, started with Aesop and then kind of moved into more Slavic culture stuff. But then he just recites some of one, I guess, in Russian. And, you know, and Chance giggles because he's never – he talked funny is basically probably what's going on in his mind.
Yeah.
And because he laughed and because it was a joke, he's like, I knew it. I knew you spoke Russian. You know, and then I was like, oh, my God, you know, how far can this go? And apparently it could almost go to the presidency.
Well, it's interesting because Ruby is 4.5 and you remember this from when your kids were young, pre-sarcasm,
right?
Before they understand what that means, everything is so, it's like Chauncey, everything is face value,
right?
Everything is taken as what
it's
the
literal,
words are and literal that is coming out of your mouth,
right?
And I will be sarcastic about stuff like, oh, that's fantastic. That's great.
And she's like, why did you say that? That's fantastic. Yeah, how could you say that?
I'm like, it's sarcasm, Ruby. You'll understand it one day. But he plays it like that, except he doesn't even have the personality of a 4-year-old.
Right.
You know, he plays it just so flat. It was pretty risky, I think.
Sure.
Because it's not a lot to draw you in. It very much leaves you on the sidelines as a viewer, I think, because you can't relate to the guy. You're rooting for him. But not because, you know, Forrest Gump, they took it too far in the other direction.
Right.
They made, you know.
Well, he had a personality where Chance is a blank canvas. And everybody just paints on him. They just paint they want on him. And he's like you, whatever the empty vessel or whatever Sellers himself said.
Right.
He's just this empty canvas that people project what they want to see on him. Where, you know, guys like the president or Forrest Gump, they have, you know, for better or worse, they have their own opinions and personality and those kind of quirks that come through, where this guy is, you know, not even – I was going to say a shapeshifter, but he's not trying to shapeshift.
No.
He's just this thing that, you know, shows you what you want to see.
Yep. Yeah. Everyone is projecting onto him what they want to hear.
Right.
And it can get a little frustrating at times too. But not because, like, someone listened to him. He really has something to say because he doesn't.
Right.
they're filling in the blanks, man.
Yeah. I think his fresh perspective is so enlightening. You know, they're all just like, okay, all right.
So funny. He's so straightforward. Shirley MacLaine, that the lovemaking scene, you know, one of the great lines is, I like to watch, Eve.
I like to watch,
And
yeah.
she, of course, takes that as he wants me to masturbate in front of him.
Right. One of the things that they cut out of the movie, and probably understandable for the time, 1979, was, you remember the gay character comes up and says, have you ever had sex with a man? And
right.
Somehow it gets to, I like to watch, and it goes, hold on, I'll go get Warren.
Right.
You know, which was hilarious. In the book, he actually goes up with somebody to a room.
Really?
And the guy takes his clothes off and starts masturbating and somehow he gets his shoe on him or whatever. But in Chance's mind, he thinks the guy's sick because he's twitching and moaning. And so he comes back downstairs. He says, where you been? He says, oh, I was with yada yada. He was sick. He says, oh, you're so considerate taking care of him. Another case where you think when he's happening, how is this going to happen? But it, you know, comes through, stumbles through it somehow.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. The
Mr. Magoo. That's who he reminds me of. Mr. Magoo.
Right.
it just came to me.
Yeah.
But like, Mr. Magoo was just walking through life and
he would
no
walk
idea.
Off the side of the building and it would just happen to be when the elevator cage got there.
Right. Or he would land on a bank robber and everybody would think, oh, you saved the day.
Right.
But,
Mr.
you know,
Magoo.
He's sort of.
Totally.
Yeah. That, I see more comparison to that than Forrest Gump, maybe.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting how he handled death because he faces it twice with both of the old men in his life.
Right.
And he immediately just kind of turns to the TV in both cases or leaves. Like that's his blanket essentially.
Right. Sure, sure.
He doesn't understand what's going on, but again, with like there's never any emotion at all. And I think people read that as like a stoicism.
Right.
You know,
there's a single tear in that last scene.
That's right. There is.
There is. There? And which was that much more powerful because there had been nothing before that.
That's
it was
right.
like he really
it finally
cared.
Gave you something.
He really cared for that guy where the guy he lived with his entire life, he was ready to watch Captain Kangaroo, you know, as soon as he died. But not to diminish what you're saying.
It no, was, but that's
there's
right.
so little emotion. And, then he may have had that tear and gone right back to. He would have tuned out into anything that was on television.
Yeah, that's really important, though. Like, they gave you that one little nugget, that one tiny little tear, which was super impactful. And, you know, as it feels like a sort of a 70s mystery in some ways, like the net is closing on him.
Right.
As the movie goes on, the whole sort of second hour of the movie. Has these various storylines where they're
everybody's investigating him.
They're getting closer and closer, and like there's nothing on this guy.
Right, right.
You know, they're taking his fingerprints off of a glass.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like for real.
They know that his suits were made in 1920.
Oh, that's right.
You know, but that's it. That's all they know about him. You know, no fingerprints, no hospital records.
Yeah.
And so he's made into this man of mystery, and he's just just kind of walking around.
I could see them remaking this movie. I hope they don't.
I hope they don't. This is one of those. I mean, certain remakes would be good, and it would depend on who it is. I would see it if it came out, but I hadn't even thought about that. That should be something I should have prepared for this podcast. If it was remade, who could pull it off?
Oh man, I don't know. Like
I could see Paul Rudd doing it. I mean, even though he's a really animated guy, I can see him doing the flat. I can see him pulling that off.
Or if they wanted to like. I'm sure like a Jim Carrey or Will Ferrell would die to do something like this.
Oh, yeah.
To really kind of take a turn
career-wise. Yeah, either of them could pull this off.
But there's so much here that is so relevant.
Yeah,
because these days it would be internet research and there would be parallels. You know, you play the president in a different way.
Right.
Because Jack Warden isn't a bad guy in this movie necessarily as the president. He gets the endorsement.
Yeah,
which is interesting.
How would this movie play out if it was in present day with social media and the 24-hour news cycle?
It would be all. It would be more like it wouldn't be nearly as quiet and slow burny. It would be a bigger deal. The president would be like some big buffoon. I think it'd just be more over the top in kind of every way.
Can you imagine Chauncey Gardner's Instagram feed? I mean, it would totally work. He would just be staring off into the sunset, and it would be like
flowers.
If the roots
trees.
Are strong.
Yeah. It's like, it would be like Jack Handy.
Jack, nice.
I think you turned me on to Jack Handy too. I'm just going to say you turned me on to everything, Jinky.
Ooh, just glad I turned you on, sweetheart.
So I guess you know we can get into the ending.
Yeah,
one of the classic most classic ambiguous endings in movie history, I think.
Right.
The old man dies, like you mentioned before, the pallbearers, you hear the whispers. The way they intercut that last scene is just so great.
Yeah.
The editing is just so wonderful.
Did you notice the Illuminati sign on the grave?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't notice that the last time I saw it.
Yeah, the Illuminati, and I think it even says life is a state of mind on the grave, which is the last line of the movie.
Right.
So the president is eulogizing Rand, and true to form, or true to his nature, Chance has wandered away into the woods to look at flowers and trees and to be himself. And if you've never, like, if you haven't seen the movie and you want to, and you've gotten this far, stop listening.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to ruin it.
Right.
It is one of the great, great endings in movie history.
Yeah.
All right. If you're still here, in the book, like we said, in the original script, it doesn't end this way, but he goes to the edge of the pond and
starts walking across it
on water.
And if you wondered if he was really walking on water, he kind of pauses and then sticks his umbrella down into it.
Right.
And then gets up and
which
then...
apparently was an improv moment.
Was it?
Yeah, Peter Sellers stopped and put the umbrella down.
Yeah.
But you know, they built a little pier a few inches below the water line.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great filmmaking decisions of all time, I think, is to change that ending.
Yeah.
Cuz it really makes it's one of those endings that makes you rethink everything you've seen.
Right.
And two bottles of wine later after the movie, you're discussing it with people.
Exactly.
On
exactly.
What you think it means.
Yeah.
So let's hear it. What do you think it means?
Oh, I wanted to ask you first, but well, I've kind of changed over time. I think when I first watched it, I thought it was this whole comment on religion in general.
Me too.
I thought, oh, this is
– Is he Jesus?
He is not Jesus, but it's basically trying to say Jesus, maybe Jesus was dim-witted or maybe mm-hmm. Jesus was just a normal guy and people saw in him what they wanted to see.
Right.
And then, you know, fast forward 100 years of interpretation and misinterpretation.
Right.
And then he's all of a sudden, maybe this guy really was just a carpenter who told a couple stories about sheep and goats.
Right.
And you know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then it was sort of turning in. So I thought it was this total commentary
yeah.
on that. Now, you know, and a part of it, though, I thought that was kind of a
pull
cheap,
that down a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go.
I kind of thought that was a bit of a cheap joke at the end because there was no, but it was sort of a 1-2 punch.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's where I was too. And
wait,
I was
what cheap joke? The
all of a sudden, Jesus is a dumbass.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And I was like, but maybe at that time in my life, that's what I projected onto that.
Yeah.
Aha, this is a very sharp criticism of organized religion and blah,
right.
blah, 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 blah.
I was the same way, dude, and we were both church boys, so
yeah, and that's maybe no that's just where I was at that point, and it's all a sham and blah, blah, blah. Now I've kind of looked back at it as sort of a life as a state of mind,
mm-hmm.
which is the last line in it, and it's sort of this idea of you know, he's been able to do everything. It's almost like he's some supernatural creature
right.
that can do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
And people are sort of charmed by it. And so the water is just is under his sway
uh-huh.
as much as anyone else. Is that the accurate?
Well,
you know,
there
depiction?
Is no right answer for sure because
is there anything? Did Ashby ever say anything? No.
Not at all. I looked and there is no right answer. I think he very much wanted it to be open to interpretation.
Right.
I saw it as a religious allegory as well when mm-hmm. I was younger. But now it's a little bit more like he doesn't know he can't walk on water.
Right, right, right.
And that's true to his character to make that leap of faith, not religious.
Right.
But to step out onto it. But it's really happening, so – that's the cool thing about movies like this. I think it's – or is it really happening? Like,
sure,
you don't have to – if you start nitpicking
– or is this the final metaphor, right?
Right.
Is this the final metaphor that we are projecting onto him?
Yeah.
Everybody, you know, everybody thinks he's speaking in metaphors.
That's really funny.
The
that's
entire time.
Totally what it is.
You know?
It's like the characters spend the whole movie doing that, and at the very end, the audience is doing that.
Yeah. Wow.
I think we figured it out.
We solved it. We figured it out.
It's such a great ending, though. And it's really – it's one of those that, you know, when they do these big Oscar award supercuts of all these great moments in cinema history.
Right.
Inevitably, there's a shot of Chauncey Gardner walking
there
across that
pond. There has to be. Yeah.
You always see it. It's like they're singing in the rain. There's Rain Man. There's
right.
this. There's
right.
Frankly, My Dear, I Don't Give a Damn. Like this is one of those cinematic moments. And it almost wasn't there.
But do you think this movie is on everybody's radar?
I mean, no.
You're more attuned to those things now, but I always thought of this as sort of this small little film that I knew, but I don't know if it's one of those
in
the pantheon.
Is, as a whole, like when I list off Last Detail and Harold and Maude, like
sure.
film people know
right.
what those movies are, but when you say great filmmakers of the 70s, people probably start talking about Scorsese and
sure,
Coppola
sure.
and Lucas, that's to be debated, but I don't think Hal Ashby is on the tops of everyone's list.
Yeah, yeah.
And he should be, because that run of films was incredible.
It really was, yeah.
And he had a way about him and his movies. Harold and Maude, you know, they were all – they weren't very just sort of straightforward Hollywood films.
Yeah.
He always had a unique angle on everything, I think. It was a really a great matching of material, actor, director – all coming together for this movie.
Yeah, it was like the
really
magic
perfect
combination special sauce, right?
Yeah, walking across that water.
Mm-hmm.
Just the best. I could watch the ending 100 times.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm trying, I think Mad Magazine ruined it for me.
I can't believe you saw the Mad Magazine version of that first.
But I mean, I didn't see this movie until much later. It might have been college.
Right. That's probably where I saw it first.
Yeah, I mean,
I didn't see it as a kid, for sure.
And I talk a lot on the show those early college years when. Because of people like you, and then getting the job at Vision Video, and really going down that road
about
of
about you working there,
that early '90s independent cinema boom from Jarmusch to Spike Lee was just like it was such a great time.
It was
to be 21 years old,
yeah.
And like really exploring that
with
stuff.
A whole room full of movies to watch. Yeah,
whole
yeah,
room
yeah.
full of movies. I mean, we would sit around and record. What's his name? Who's the preacher? They ended up doing the...
Reverend Bob Tilton?
Reverend Bob Tilton.
Yeah, put your hand on the screen.
Yeah.
Put your hand on the screen,
see,
ladies and gentlemen.
You were YouTube, man. Like, later on YouTube, people would do him, like, farting and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Whereas you guys would just record that shit off late-night TV, and we would sit around and watch it.
Clay and I had tons of stuff. I remember us watching that, Geraldo Rivera getting hit with a chair in the nose.
Yes,
like,
dude.
In slow-mo, play-by-play. And
every
then...
time I came... You guys were YouTube. Every time I came over... You had something on a video cassette that you were recorded that we would
right.
all sit around and watch and laugh at.
Who was the tap dancing bandit? Do you remember that guy?
Oh, Jesco White.
Jesco White. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That era of stuff.
That's right, man. Yeah, I totally forgot about that. He was great. What was his name? I can't remember exactly what it was.
No.
It was Jesco, but he was the whatever.
The tap dancing bandit or
something
like that. Yeah.
And then... we would listen to Dr. Dre's The Chronic and play Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat.
Yep. That was Clay and Jason Hughes. I was not a big fan of Dre, but we did listen.
Oh, really?
I was never a big – I mean, I liked a lot of hip-hop. I was more in Public Enemy back then.
Sure.
But Luna and Camper Van Beethoven.
Yeah.
And there was tons of stuff we all loved, too.
Yeah. Oh, it's the best.
Yeah.
I still love Luna. Just saw them recently. And I'm trying to get Chuck D on the show.
And
I finally got an insider connection who's someone who knows him personally. And they talked to him, and he was like, he literally has like 100 interviews lined up.
Uh-huh.
And he said, but, you know, I'm into it, but it's not going to be anytime soon. If that ever happens, I'll let you know so you can like accidentally be in Atlanta.
Yeah. I would love that. Yeah.
He's a guy that's like high on my list for, you know, dream guests.
Wow.
I would love to sit down with him.
I mean, it's no Christopher Walken talking about Footloose, right?
Come on.
Dude, I couldn't even listen to that.
Really?
Well, I was so uncomfortable for you.
Well, you knew it was a gag, right?
No.
That wasn't real. That was a guy. That was Kevin Pollak. So you thought that
I just saw it.
It was an April Fool's episode.
Okay. Because I was like, "What the hell?"
Yeah.
And so then you're like, "Oh, I'm so nervous about this." I don't know if your publicist do that.
Yeah.
And
if you don't like awkward.
And then he started, and it was too awkward. I was like, "I was so nervous for you." I turned it off. I didn't even see the date when it came out.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, it was an April Fool's thing. Kevin Pollak, the actor, is a master impressionist, and we cooked that one up.
Oh, classic.
Yeah,
well, it was classic. Well,
it's funny. Some people are fooled, and some people are like, "Oh, that was the worst Walken I've ever heard." And I'm like, "No, what are you talking about? It was great." Oh, dude, this is so much fun.
Oh, it was.
You got any final thoughts on being there?
No. I think we cracked it.
Yeah,
I think it's the final metaphor.
We solved it.
We are the painters of the canvas, man.
Nice. You should come on again next time you come through town.
I'd like
that. Let's make this a regular thing.
Yeah, right on. That'd be fun.
Thanks, brother.
Right.
All right, perfect. That was great.
Yeah, very cool. I had the questions answered, too. You have some questions that...
Hold on.
If you want that.
Yeah. Oh, wait. Before we go, are we still recording? We got to do the five questions. I haven't done this with a real guest in so long. We've been doing so many, like, round tables.
Oh, right, okay.
And, like, people in the office that it fell off my radar. So... What was let me see if I remember him. What was the first movie you saw in a theater?
It was funny. I had you know, since I'm in the States, I went and asked my mom about it.
Oh, really?
And she says that the first movie I saw was Herbie the Love Bug
The
Fox. At the Fox, like, you know, probably in a stroller or something when it came out, when the Fox still showed movies. But I mean, this is just how many brain cells are gone. The first movie I remember seeing in a theater, kind of it mixes with your second question about our movie. I remember sneaking into DC Cab.
Oh, yeah.
The one, like, I think Bill Maher and Mr. T or somebody is in it. Yep. Like, some ridiculous movie. It was the first time I saw boobs on a screen.
Yeah.
And I remember that vividly.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah, DC Cab.
Yeah. So that's the first movie that I still remember on a screen. I'm sure I saw some, you know, I probably saw Bambi or something like that.
Yeah.
And I don't remember.
Kid stuff.
But sneaking in.
So first R-rated movie? DC Cab?
I think before that, the first R-rated movie I saw was Halloween in Gatlinburg in a hotel room.
Whoa.
Cable. My cousin, older cousin, like foolishly said, hey, we're going to go watch Halloween in our hotel room. Do you want to watch it? I don't know what we were in Gatlinburg for.
Yeah.
But, and I went, sure. I didn't even know what it was. I thought it was like a Charlie Brown special. And I saw Halloween at whatever age it came out and was on cable in a hotel room.
Uh-huh.
And I was afraid of the dark for years after that.
Wow.
Halloween really scared the shit out of me.
Sure.
And so, but I.
It scares the shit out of me now.
I vividly, vividly remember that. And then.
So, how old were you?
I should have looked up when, you know, like, I should have done sort of a backwards, but I had to be 10, you know, maybe.
That's scary.
I was way too young to see that, for sure. Uh-huh. I'd have to look at when it came out. I mean, what, Jamie Lee Curtis was like 17 or something.
She was young.
So I must have been much younger than
Are
that.
Are you into horror movies?
Not really. My girl is into It right now.
Oh, really?
And that was from Stranger Things. She went from, because she's the same age as like the protagonist.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I started looking up horror movies. And of course, you know, preparing for this episode, I went and listened to Evil Dead, because Evil Dead 2 is one of my favorite movies of all time, in Army of Darkness.
Yeah.
I used to watch that every Halloween until Keiko just couldn't take it anymore. She's like, nope, because her birthday is Halloween.
Oh, really?
And she's like, I do not want to spend my birthday watching Blood Gush.
Yeah.
Can we do something else? You know, she didn't say that, but it was
implied. So you watch it on the October 30th now?
I need to watch. I think my girl is old enough to watch it now. Now, you know, a year ago, I tried to show her Kung Fu Hustle, and it was too violent for her. This is just this. You'll be looking forward to this with Ruby when she gets her teen. And within a year, she wants to watch It with me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Genuinely scary.
Which I'm too scared for. So I may be watching some horror movies with her if she goes in that direction. But when I've tried to suggest some, she's like, Dad, you don't get it. I want to watch It because it has people my age.
Right.
You know, I wanted to watch Stranger Things because it's people my age. I don't want to go see people stabbing each other unless there's a 13-year-old on screen.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, okay. All right. So.
Man, she sounds great.
Yeah, she's cool.
What is number three?
I think it was, have you ever walked out or would you walk out of a movie?
All right. Have you?
In general, I don't go to the theater as much.
Did I walk out of a movie with you?
You did.
Do you remember? Judge Dredd?
Close.
What was it? We walked out of something and went into True Romance again, right?
Demolition Man.
Yeah.
That's right. That's the last movie I can remember walking out of. I probably have walked out of
one. I didn't know if you were with me. I remember very
distinctly. It was you and Chappie and maybe Clay. I can't remember. But
I remember Brett being there for sure because I think he was the first one that said,
he was like, let's get out of here.
And we went and saw True Romance again.
Again. Yeah. But I mean, that was a great decision.
Demolition
Man. I have walked out of movies before, but I can't think of any. I think maybe I've walked out of one that was too scary for the kids when they were like young, but I can't even remember what it was. Cause it's weird in like places like Malaysia and Thailand.
Sure.
You will go to see Frozen
and
they will have a trailer for a slasher film before it.
Yeah. They don't match it up.
And they don't match it up. And so the kids would be like, we have to leave now. And it's like, no, Frozen's not going to be like this.
You know?
I still remember in Chiang Mai or something, but, there's some movie that I just misjudged how old they were and I've walked out, but I can't even remember what it is now.
I remember seeing Pulp Fiction on opening day with you guys too in Athens.
Right.
And that was such a big deal because the Reservoir Dogs thing.
Yeah,
like, we were into
that.
That was when
Quentin Tarantino was like an unknown, or at least unknown to us. I'm sure he was a
unknown to a lot of people, but like because of Dogs, we were all like primed for that.
We have to go
first,
see this.
Like,
yeah.
noon showing yeah. Friday of Pulp Fiction.
I think we went to go see the opening night of, was it Bram Stoker's Dracula together, too?
Oh, really?
Because, well, I was just a big Gary Oldman fan right. back then. I thought Gary Oldman could do no wrong.
I've now learned
that he can do wrong. Well, sure. But he's usually doing wrong to fund some movie he wants to make himself or something like that.
Yeah,
so I'll forgive
true.
Him for that.
Number four, I think, is one I usually tailor to the guest, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Oh, boy. What should I go with here then, Jinky? All right. How about this? You're mm-hmm. an artist. What movie about an artist is like your favorite?
That's a good question.
I've got a few that come to my mind already, but I don't know if...
I like Basquiat. Basquiat's the first one that came to mind.
That was good.
There was one about Jasper Johns that Ed Harris was in I didn't like.
I don't know. He was...
Jackson Pollock. Thank you. I said Jasper Johns. Trying to think of some others. There's one with Willem Dafoe doing Van Gogh that I haven't seen yet.
I haven't seen that either.
I really liked Salma Hayek's movie on Frida Kahlo, but... Also, because now I know the whole backstory. Uh-huh. I don't know if you read that whole piece about her experience with Harvey Keitel.
Yeah, yeah.
And how he bullied her with
Harvey
that
Weinstein,
movie.
Yeah.
What did I say?
Harvey Keitel.
Oh, God. Poor guy. So anyway, Weinstein was, you know, such
yeah,
a creep.
He was
awful. And then, but for her to have been able to pull that off with all of that makes me love that movie even more.
Yeah, for sure.
But what are some others? I'm just drawing a blank
here.
No,
Basquiat is certainly a great one. Which is the one that... Or maybe I'm thinking because he is an artist, Julian
Schnabel.
Schnabel, but he didn't make a movie about an artist. But his films are great.
Yeah, I liked the stuff that Björk's husband did too. He's an installation artist, a really famous guy that I can't remember his name right
it's
now.
It's interesting. Andy Warhol has been in a bunch of, or someone playing Andy Warhol has mm-hmm. been in a bunch of films from. The Doors to, you know, he's popped up in a lot of movies
right.
as a character, but no one's ever really nailed a good.
No.
I Shot Andy Warhol was good, but that
was that
less...
where Bowie played him?
I can't remember.
Bowie
but that was
played
more
Warhol
about
in
the
one of them.
Girl who shot him
right.
than him.
Exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, a good Warhol biopic would be interesting.
A good Warhol biopic would be good. Maybe a question, who would I want to see?
Well, a Dalí film would be great.
A great Dalí film about Dalí, not, you know, not Dalí. I mean, Dalí directing. I don't know if you ever saw that. That may have been some sort of Clay and Jason YouTube thing. Did you ever see Dalí's films, like the ones he did with Disney or the ones he did on his own?
I don't think so.
Dalí has this one bit where this, I don't know, this strange little midget comes up and hands him a piece of foil.
Uh-huh.
And there's like a bust of some Greek god sitting on a piano next to him. And as he's looking at the screen, he's literally looking at you eye to eye.
Uh-huh.
And he's fiddling with this piece of foil in his hand and he's talking. And then he just shows it to you and he's made like a freeze, like, you know, he's made the face of the bust
wow.
on there as he's talking to you. It's insane. It's
wow.
insane. So I would love to see that. We actually went to his mausoleum. It's a little
amazing.
North of Barcelona
uh-huh.
and it's like it's a museum in itself. It's incredible. So yeah, would definitely like to see a movie about Dalí's life.
I remember you telling me, I got so many specific memories about you from college when you told me about when Dalí was on The Tonight Show
mm-hmm.
and he put a duck on his head and said, right. Dalí is not crazy.
That's right.
Like, I remember you telling me that story one
Dalí
afternoon.
Dalí is not crazy at all. That's right. That's right.
So great.
So Dalí would be great. I'd like to see a Moneyball-type movie about Koons.
Oh, wow.
Because Koons is a controversial guy in how he produces his art and,
uh-huh.
and how he gets money. Same with Hearst, Damien Hearst.
Yeah.
Love him or hate him, he has played the art world in ways.
Yeah.
And, of course, Banksy. I mean, yeah, there you go.
Oh,
you
wow.
want to talk about movies about artists, I consider Banksy an artist, and Exit Through the Gift Shop.
Oh, that was great.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, that was great.
And it was funny, actually, the way we watched that was we bootlegged it and this
he would have appreciated
this
that.
Dutch friend of mine basically scouted out a roof in Omotesando in this area, Tokyo, where we used to hang out. And so and got a projection screen and had a screening of it uh-huh. on the roof
on like a projection screen.
Oh,
so
wow.
We watched it.
That's
like,
very Banksy.
You know, this, it was very. It felt that way. We all felt like we were rebelling in one way or another. But we had to be quiet because
yeah.
It was like a residential building and nobody knew we were up there. But it was fun.
Are you still doing stuff? You still painting or?
Dude, I wish I was. No, I mean, you know, I still do some photography.
Uh-huh.
I try to nurture that in my kids too. I haven't done any real creative things for myself in a while, and I need to remedy that.
I still
sure.
have that crazy chalk that you did for me.
I did one for you?
Yes, dude, you gave me one when we moved away. I've still
got
it.
Wow. Wow.
It's like a crazy sort of fluorescent creature eating his own hand. He's doing something. I've got it in my closet. I've kept it all these years.
Next time you pull it out,
I'm going to frame
it. Snap a shot of it and send it to me. I'd be curious to see what it is.
Yeah.
So
it's awesome.
Wow. Wow,
cool. And then what's your deal in the movie theater? What do you set? What's your routine?
I guess it's top.
Depends on what country you're in.
I put different things. As far as where I sit, I usually try to sit near the back on the aisle. And it depends on which way the bathroom is. But like,
okay.
You know, top. Top left center, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
I like to be, or top right center. As far as what I, you know, eat in there,
uh-huh.
It all depends on the theater.
Yeah.
In Japan, you can bring in stuff.
Okay.
You can just, I'll carry in sushi rolls and cans of beer.
Uh-huh.
In Malaysia, you have to buy stuff there. They don't have butter popcorn. They have like Earl Grey tea flavored popcorn or something.
Oh,
so
wow.
I'll get that. Or I'll sneak stuff in.
Uh-huh.
Spain, usually just popcorn. Butter popcorn. As a kid, it was Milk Duds.
Right.
But it was all Milk Duds. But
yeah,
then
yeah.
Now it's popcorn. In Mexico, Mexico's theater, it's Takis and beer.
Oh, really?
And beer. I always bring Takis and beer. But then in Japan, it'd be beer and senbe, that kind of stuff I just gave you. That,
uh-huh.
I just brought a few little snacks for Chuck from Japan, and I would bring a couple of those bags in.
I've only seen one movie in a different country. Oh, actually, that's not true. I saw the most recent Spike Lee movie in Australia.
Oh, right.
But I saw Pulp Fiction. Brett and I saw Pulp Fiction in, I guess it was... Where was that? We were in Vienna.
Oh, right. Okay.
So we went and saw Pulp Fiction in Vienna.
Awesome.
Because we just wanted a foreign
sure.
film experience.
Right, right.
Which
yeah.
wasn't a foreign film at all, of course, for us. But it was interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, theaters, they look the same all over, you
yeah.
know? I mean, the theaters in Thailand or in Spain, you know, were pretty much the same, the theater in Mexico. But the rules by which people... you know, experience that.
Right.
I think I listened to the one, I forgot her name, but your Princess Bride episode.
Yes.
And she was talking about how she was a shusher.
Yeah, Molly.
And uh-huh. I am a shusher too.
Uh-huh.
I actually just did it. I did it when we went to go see Knives Out the other night.
Really?
And my kids get embarrassed.
Uh-huh.
But the woman in front of us was on her phone. I mean, she wasn't
like
No, she wasn't talking. So this isn't shushing, but she was literally
yeah.
just like with her phone on all bright. And I was just leaned over and was like, excuse me, could you turn that off, you know,
yeah.
just for an hour and a half? And my kids were like, oh, God,
yeah.
Dad, why'd you do that?
What'd
you
she know? Do? What'd the lady do?
She turned it off.
Oh, okay.
You know, but in Mexico, it seemed like every other person was doing that. And
really?
I just would give up. I would get the people to turn it off near me. But in Taiwan 10, 15 years ago, people would answer the phone. They'd be
really?
Like, what? Oh, I'm just in the movie. What are you doing?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so, but I think those rules are changing. But,
interesting.
But yeah, but yeah. etiquette, movie etiquette, you know, you still get the same announcements. Please turn off your
right.
phone. Please don't talk. But, you know, some movies people take those as
world.
Suggestions.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, when you come back, we'll have to talk more about that because that's fascinating
yeah,
to
yeah.
me.
Sure. It'd be great.
It's like people talk. People love movies all over the world, and I think
they
in
do.
America you get a very America-centric mind
mm-hmm.
set.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like people love movies everywhere.
They do, and I'll leave you with this one fact that you know if you find this stuff interesting, you
uh-huh.
might find this interesting. When we were living in Malaysia, we mm-hmm. lived in Penang, this little island close to the Thai border, and super fancy theaters, you know, that were. Freezing cold, like, you know, I walked in flip-flops and I brought a fleece because
right.
it was so cold. But when movies came there, and this is advice when people ask me about going to Malaysia, if they want to go to a movie, which we recommend, it's a nice experience, but you need to see the movie right away
mm-hmm.
because in Malaysia,
They have the latest Hollywood blockbusters in English, but then they also have movies in Bahasa. They have movies in Tamil. They have movies in Fujian Chinese,
wow.
in, you know, Cantonese and Mandarin. And so the turnover is so fast because they're
catering
to multiple
audiences. So you'll
get the
English language version for like a week?
A week, unless it's like, you know, Star Wars
right.
or something like that.
Yeah.
But if it's just a middle-of-the-road blockbuster,
uh-huh.
you know, a Knives Out would stay for a week.
Wow.
Max, maybe 4 days. So it's like as soon as it comes,
you got to go.
We got to go. We got to go see it. You know?
That's so cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks, dude.
Hey, my pleasure.
And we'll definitely get you back in here again.
I'd love that.
All right. All right, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I hope we did not talk too much about the old days to the detriment of the show, but we were catching up a little bit, and I hope you got a nice little peek into that. Jason, it was so good to have him in here. I love him like a brother, and it was so good to reconnect, and we are going to keep in better touch from now on. We made that pledge to each other. A lot of great thoughts on being there, just as I knew he would. I knew he'd be a great guest because Jason has great taste, and he is a smart dude. So thanks, Jason, for coming in here. Thanks to you all for listening, and we will see you next time. Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.